This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham.
When you hear the phrase separation of church and state, what comes to mind? America's founding fathers? The First Amendment? The Baptist Church? It might surprise you to know that while all three are relevant, that third one, the Baptist Church, may just be the most on target. If you've guessed that some little appreciated American history is just ahead, then you are on target. Our legal scholar guest has indeed long been fascinated by church-state issues that span the centuries. And as you may well know, separation of church and state is also a key factor in a recent landmark Supreme Court decision. So with history and current events at stake, we figured it was a perfect time to be meeting up with law professor Anne Massey. And we will, right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Now, until recently, if you heard the word Greece, you probably thought either of a land near the Mediterranean, something you put on an axle, or a 1970s musical. Now, however, if you follow news about the U.S. Supreme Court, you have become aware that there is actually a town named Greece in the state of New York, and that that town figures prominently in a landmark decision about religion and government. Here to help us better understand the Supreme Court ruling handed down in early May of 2014, as well as to help with insight on a long history of religious freedom issues, Professor of Law from Washington and Lee University, Anne Massey. Thank you so very much for making time for us.
Well, Tom, thank you for inviting me. I'm looking forward to this hour. I think it will be interesting and a lot of fun. I know these topics are very important to people. A number of people are quite interested, so I hope we have some interested folks tuning in.
Well, Professor Massey, let me ask you then, should we start with Greece or Thomas Jefferson or somewhere in between?
I think I would recommend starting with the language of the First Amendment.
Okay.
Religious freedom is often referred to as our first freedom because the amendment begins, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So we have one clause, but with two aspects, often called two clauses. Free exercise protects the rights of people to worship as they see fit. The Establishment Clause says government may not favor one religion over another, may not establish any kind of church or religion, and the Supreme Court has often said, may not prefer religion over non-religion. Now, Thomas Jefferson, when he was elected president in 1800, made it very clear that he thought this meant a very strict separation between religion on the one hand and government on the other. And so, in a rather famous letter in which he wrote in 1802 to the Danbury Baptist Association.
This is Danbury, Connecticut.
Danbury, Connecticut. It was actually an association of all the Baptists in Connecticut. They were quite a minority at the time. And what I think people often don't realize is that the First Amendment, when it was framed and enacted, drafted, and ratified, applied only to the federal government, only to Congress. Congress shall make no law. It did not apply to the states. So many of the states had actually state-established religions.
Including Virginia.
By then Virginia had already enacted the statute on religious liberty that Jefferson had authored with Madison, but primarily Jefferson was the author. There was a time when the colony of Virginia favored Anglicanism. And a number of states collected taxes that went to the favored church. As they loosened up a bit, those taxes could perhaps go to the denomination of the person's choice. But there were laws that you had to attend church on Sundays and things like that. So the Baptists in Connecticut felt quite persecuted, and they wrote to Jefferson expressing their gratitude for his position on religious freedom. And he wrote back to them that I regard with great reverence the high wall of separation between church and state. In fact, I contemplate with solemn reverence that act of the whole American people, which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state. Now, that wall of separation has been referred to in a number of Supreme Court opinions. In fact, a current commentator says he thinks that the current Supreme Court is dismantling it brick by brick, but Jefferson certainly believed in the wall, and a number of Supreme Court cases reflect such an understanding. Where confusion started to arise was after the Supreme Court made the First Amendment applicable to the states, not just to the federal government. That was in the 1940s. And after that, cases began to arise because states had long since stopped having state-sponsored religions, but nonetheless, there were practices in place, such as, and I remember this, teachers at the beginning of the school day in the public school system leading the students in prayer, and often that was the Lord's Prayer, followed by the Pledge of Allegiance. Sometimes Bible verses would be read. These practices were challenged in the 1960s, and the court began to strike down prayer in public schools. They said that children were a vulnerable population, quite subject to influence, certainly by what their teachers said, and that it was not the business of public employees, state employees, or local government to indoctrinate children with religious beliefs and values. That was a matter for parents and the home and the church, but not the state. So they began to strike those down. And then finally, in a case in, I think, 1992 called Lee versus Wiseman, the court said that even invocations and benedictions at graduation ceremonies violated the Constitution if offered at the behest of the school, which was frequently what happened.
And this was public schools.
This was only public schools.
K through 12.
Right.
For any
the Constitution
kind of
applies only to public actors, state actors or government actors of any kind, state, federal.
But specifically for children in a school.
K through 12. Yes.
Right. Where they're considered minors.
Right. Okay. Exactly. And they said children should not be coerced into having to listen to a religious message with which they disagreed, or even worse, to a choice between attending their own graduation ceremony or staying away in order to avoid a feeling of having to join in a prayer with which they disagreed. So, no more prayer in public schools. Now, what happened in Town of Greece versus Galloway was that there were prayers offered at town hall meetings. Now, this is not at all unusual. It's very common.
It's come up in some Virginia cases
in recent years. Oh, yes, a number.
But this is a town in upstate New York that's a bedroom community for the city of Rochester.
Right.
And for many years, the town council would open its meeting with someone, whether it was a minister or a priest or a layperson, offering a prayer facing the audience of the people who were there to appear before the town council or to attend that public meeting.
That's right. In fact, they're still doing it. And it goes on in probably, I might think, most local governmental meetings, whether county board of supervisors, town or city councils, what have you. And that, in turn, stems from a behavior, a habit of legislative prayer, both in the Congress and in most state legislatures.
Do I recall, legal scholar Ann Massey, that you've told me in the past that when the U.S. Congress first met, among the first orders of business, I mean, we're talking back in the
1789,
in both chambers, in both the Senate and the House, was the selection of chaplains.
Of a chaplain to lead the legislative session in prayer, each legislative session.
So that's certainly a long tradition for Congress, and you mentioned it also has been for state legislatures.
That's right. On the state level, that practice was validated in a case called Marsh versus Chambers in 1983.
But I understand that in this case, where the Supreme Court in May of 2014, at the beginning of May, came out with a 5-4 decision, they ruled on something that some people saw as quite different, that in legislatures or in Congress, where there's a chaplain offering a prayer at the beginning of a session, it's often been thought that that prayer is being offered for those legislators, those Congress members. But if you have somebody, at least the plaintiffs in the Greece case were arguing, if you have somebody standing up in front of an audience of people who are there to make an appeal to their town council or to listen to the meeting, and that those people are forced to listen to a religious message that they don't agree with, that that's kind of a violation of separation of church and state.
That was the argument. Now, in Marsh versus Chambers, the state case, the court said certainly the people who framed the First Amendment knew what it meant. They thought it was all right for the House and Senate of the federal government to have chaplains. State governments could do that as well. But it is true that the audiences in those two situations are the legislators themselves. There was a strong argument in Town of Greece mounted by the plaintiffs that you are talking about something completely different when you are talking about town councils addressing maybe 10 people there, typically, they said in that case. I think generally a small audience in almost any town or city. And they said they felt coerced into participating in the prayer with which they disagreed, just as the children in Lee versus Wiseman felt coerced to participate in the prayer, the invocations and benedictions at graduation. The court said, no, an adult cannot really be coerced in that way. And some of the cases talking about city councils have said, well, it's really for the benefit of the legislators, just like the state and federal situation.
The town council members, the
town
county
council
board of
members
supervisors.
To bring them together, to solemnize the occasion, to sort of focus their attention on the serious business that they are about to consider.
That was what the winning side of the Supreme Court said, because they had the 5 votes.
But
it was a split decision. There were 4 other members of the Supreme Court who vehemently disagreed. So I want to get more of both sides on that from you, if we could, Ann Massey, when we get back from the break, and what you think it means going into the future in terms of other religion and government-related issues. And we're also going to invite you there on the other side of your radio to participate. We'll be back in just a bit more than one. To you listening in, when is it appropriate for religion and government to intersect? How much have you already heard about the U.S. Supreme Court's 5-4 ruling saying that local government bodies can offer sectarian prayer in their meetings? You have questions about that ruling, insights to share. Ann Massey, Washington and Lee University Professor of Law is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. More about the May 2014 ruling.
Right.
Greece versus
Town
Galloway.
Of Greece versus Galloway.
And Susan Galloway was
one of the two plaintiffs
who filed this suit, one an atheist and one who was Jewish.
That's right. That's right. And they apparently attend a number of town meetings. And what they noted was that the prayers were invariably Christian. Now, the town's policy was that they didn't discriminate, that anyone could offer a prayer, or I suppose you might say a statement, prior to the meeting, because atheists could be among those eligible to offer the thought. But all of the houses of worship located within the town of Greece, in fact, are Christian. So the way they got their list of so-called chaplains of the month to call on was from a list maintained by the Chamber of Commerce of all the houses of worship in the town of Greece. So they would simply call until they found someone willing to come and offer the prayer at the beginning of the next town meeting.
So their argument was, we are not doing this on purpose. We're not trying as town leaders, as government officials, to foist Christian beliefs on anyone. It's just that it just so happens that within our town borders, Christianity is all that's offered.
Right.
Which, I got to tell you, strikes me as a specious argument, only because I know the town of Greece well enough to realize it borders a city where there are many different places of worship and many people in the town of Greece. If they were Jewish or if they were Muslim or they were Unitarian, they would go 2 or 3 miles into the city of Rochester to attend their place of worship.
Yes. And in fact, when these women first objected to the practice, the town did reach out across its borders. They brought in a Jewish layman, gave a prayer. A member of the Baha'i faith gave a prayer. And a Wiccan priestess gave a prayer. But apparently, after those interludes, they went back to their usual practice. So,
and this was something they did only after the lawsuit was filed.
Yes, that's right.
After many, many, many years of having only Christian prayer at their meetings.
Right.
So in the Supreme Court decision, the conservatives on the court held sway. They had the 5 votes to say the town of Greece has not violated the U.S. Constitution. They can keep doing what they've been doing.
That's right. Justice Kennedy wrote the opinion, and he said the surprising thing was not that they okayed the notion of a town offering prayer at its meetings. But the perhaps surprising aspect of the case was that the court actually said that sectarian prayer was also all right. That came up in the context of the fact that prior cases from the court had indicated really quite strongly that prayers offered in a public space like this one ought to be non-sectarian, ought to avoid reference to specific doctrines. And there were several comments in prior cases to this effect. But here, the court said, well, judges have no business dictating what a prayer should say, or certainly not the town has no business editing prayers ahead of time. That would really entangle government and religion. You can't tell them how to pray, and how could a person reading a prayer or listening to a prayer but representing the government actually even say what is sectarian and what is non-sectarian? What is sectarian in one person's eyes might not be in another's.
So one of the things that I think you're underscoring here, Ann Massey, is that this, by many legal scholars, this Supreme Court ruling is seen as a change. That even as recently as early 2013, based on previous Supreme Court decisions. A federal district court in Virginia ruled that the county of Pennsylvania, down around Danville, was violating the Constitution by offering Christian-based prayers that were very sectarian. And the federal district court judge says, you have to stop that. You have to do more open. If you're going to have prayers, they have to not be offending anybody or not celebrating any one particular religion. And that district court judge was basing that ruling on the general understanding of Supreme Court precedent up until now.
That's right. In fact, Justice Elena Kagan, in her dissent, quotes the language that the House of Representatives gives to those who are going to give prayer in its chamber. And it strongly suggests non-sectarian language. It also limits prayers to 150 words, which might be useful in and of itself. And she said, you know, people who are told or suggested that we'd like to have you pray, but we would like it to be a non-sectarian, inclusive kind of prayer that as many people as possible could join in or at least not be offended by. She said, people do this all the time, whether they're priests, whether they're Protestant clergy, whether they're Jewish rabbis, whether they are Muslim imams, whether they represent Baha'i or, in one case, the Dalai Lama in Congress. She said it's really not difficult for them to understand what they are being asked to do when they are given this language. And she strenuously dissented from what Justice Kennedy, for the majority, was saying.
Well, personal admission time for me here. I actually grew up near the town of Greece, New York, and as I recall, my high school always seemed to best theirs in basketball championships. But now those folks have achieved fame as the center of this Supreme Court ruling concerning separation of church and state. Whether you listening in have ever heard of that town of Greece or not, if you've got thoughts on church and state issues, you are welcome to participate in today's discussion. And on Facebook, we are listed as Virginia Insight. And we have this here from Jennifer on our Facebook page who asks, does the Supreme Court decision have any bearing on whether prayer in public schools will one day again be allowed?
No, I don't think it does. I mean, Justice Kennedy was very firmly, he writes a number of the religion opinions, and he was also very firmly of the view that the children felt coerced, that they should not be subjected to that, and that prayer in public schools has no place, not even at a graduation ceremony by way of benediction or invocation.
Are there other justices, do you think, on the Supreme Court among that conservative majority who see it differently? Are there justices that...
Oh, yes.
Who would like to have prayer back in public schools?
Would like to might be a strong way of putting it. I think that personal opinion can be difficult to discern. But certainly both Justices Scalia and Thomas think that coercion means real coercion by the state, not the sort of subtle pressure.
Being exposed
that,
to somebody
yes,
else's
that
prayer.
These women, they say, felt at these town meetings. The
women, but as far as Jennifer is concerned, as far as this
right,
particular Supreme Court decision
right,
and the Supreme Court makeup of today, it doesn't seem like prayer in public schools is coming back anytime soon.
No, I don't think it is at all.
We also have this from Nancy on the WMRA Virginia Insight Facebook page. Professor Ann Massey Nancy says, quote, please read George Washington's 1790 letter to the Touro Synagogue congregation in Newport, Rhode Island on the Bill of Rights. To bigotry, no sanction, and to persecution, no assistance. I also like the Virginia Act for Establishing Religious Freedom. I believe in strict separation of church and state. It is our most important freedom, end quote, from Nancy. Any response?
Well, I am familiar with the language she's referring to. As I understand it, or as I have read, it actually came from a meeting between President Washington at the time and those Jewish leaders. And they used the language that you have cited. And when President Washington addressed them the next day, he cited that language right back to them. And in other words, he seemed to have a view similar to Jefferson's, that the separation was pretty strict. Now, Washington was willing to declare the day of Thanksgiving, which Jefferson was not. Most presidents have, and now Congress has made it an annual holiday on the fourth Thursday of November.
Do you think that was seen in the days of Washington and Jefferson as a much more religious idea than perhaps it is seen today?
The day of Thanksgiving? I think probably so. The idea that Thanksgiving means thanking someone. And of course, it was started as a religious holiday, or at least what we celebrate with the pilgrims and what we call the first Thanksgiving, though some people more familiar with Jamestown might dispute whether it was the first. Nonetheless, that's what we look to. And of course, it was very much a religious celebration.
Church and state legal scholar Anne Massey is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We've got some phone lines open. So getting back to this most recent Supreme Court ruling that I think surprised many people, because as you've noted, it was seemed to be a little bit of a diversion from precedent.
Right.
Town of Greece versus Galloway, or Galloway versus Town of Greece. The 5-4 decision, that says that local governments before an audience can be offering Christian prayer, just like the Town of Greece long has done. Now, how important a ruling is that?
Well, I think it's quite important. I think, you cited the Pennsylvania case and the district court that reversed the practice of offering Christian prayer there. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals in this case had reversed the district court, which said the prayer is okay. The Second Circuit said, no, it's not, because it's so sectarian. The Supreme Court reversed the Second Circuit. The Second Circuit was likewise going with language from prior Supreme Court cases.
Are you referring now to the route that the Town of Greece case took?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's right. So, and Justice Kennedy does say in the majority opinion that this does not mean there's no constraint on what can happen. He says if we had any notion that the Town of Greece was discriminating against, favoring one religion over another, or favoring Christianity over, say, Judaism or Islam or any other faith, or perhaps over non-religion, that doesn't seem to be very important here. In any event, he said if we saw a pattern that constituted discrimination, we would look at it differently. But they saw no such pattern, despite the facts, because there were only Christian congregations in the town of Greece. It's true that there were Jewish congregations, synagogues, very close to the town of Greece borders in the city of Rochester, but not in the town of Greece. And so the majority of the court said, this is not a problem. They're not really discriminating. It's not their fault. All the congregations in the town of Greece, the religious groups, are in fact Christian.
So why do you see this as a particularly important ruling?
Because it does permit sectarian prayer. And some of the prayers that are quoted in the opinion are really quite sectarian. That is, They don't just say, we pray in Jesus' name. Some of them do that. But some of them say, we pray in the name of your Son, who was resurrected and who is Savior of the world and will one day raise all of us who believe in him and that sort of thing. So
a really, person who is Jewish or atheist or Muslim or Buddhist sitting in the audience as a resident of Greece might feel offended by that. Or any town.
Or certainly excluded.
Now, okay, we're going to go back to that, but we've had some people waiting on the phone line here. So let's not keep Jim in Edinburgh waiting too much longer. Jim, thanks for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for legal scholar Ann Massey, please.
Ms. Massey, it's two questions. The separation, is that from a... Those terms, is that from a Supreme Court decision? I'm familiar with the non-establishment clause of the Constitution.
Jim, you missed the beginning of our discussion. So, Anne, would you repeat what you'd said at the outset?
Yes. The wall of separation metaphor itself comes from a letter written by Thomas Jefferson in 1802 to the Danbury Baptist Association. It's not in the Constitution, but a number of Supreme Court cases have, in fact, referred to it. So the idea of, quote, separation of church and state is not foreign to the Supreme Court, though Chief Justice Berger long ago, who used the wall metaphor himself, but he did say it's not so much a hard wall as it is a sort of wavy and permeable barrier, depending upon the situation.
Jim, you said you have a second question?
Yes. If you applied the non-establishment clause to foreign policy, not just local domestic, would it preclude giving foreign aid to countries that had an established religion and actually prohibited other religions?
No, I don't think so. The foreign policy under the Constitution is left up to the political branches. That would be the Congress and the President. For the court to start looking at that sort of thing would actually be to transgress its appropriate jurisdiction. And I'm sure they would consider it a political question. That is, a question that they could not, by virtue of their office, deal with.
Jim, such great questions. Thank you for sharing them with us. We're going to continue our discussion on this issue of separation of church and state with legal scholar Ann Massey in just a bit more than 1 minute. 888-WMRA-TALK is the easy way to remember our phone number, but if you prefer all numbers, then it's 888-967-2825. Former Atlanta, Georgia attorney in private practice, former staff attorney for the Federal Trade Commission, former clerk to Virginia-based U.S. Court of Appeals Judge Jay Wilkinson, but for almost 30 years now, member of the law school faculty at Washington and Lee University, Ann Massey is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham, going next to Harrisonburg for another Jim. This Jim, thank you for joining us. Your question or comment for Professor Massey, please. Jim, we're having a little trouble hearing you. I'm not sure if it's on our end or your side, so try talking again if you would.
I became an ordained minister online and took the documents to the courthouse and became eligible to perform weddings throughout the state of Virginia. So why then would I not be eligible to deliver an invocation anywhere in the state of Virginia?
Well, I would think you might be. Those online ordinations have posed some interesting questions in various cases. The ability to perform marriage ceremonies is defined by state law. Virginia, in fact, is very generous in its definitions of who may perform such marriages. In fact, anyone may go down to the courthouse and at least obtain the right to perform a particular marriage, and my husband has done that on at least three occasions that I can think of, maybe four. But in some states, what you are describing is not really recognized as performing a legitimate marriage. Now, or a legitimate wedding ceremony. We could go into whether that violates establishment, but I think, frankly, that's a fairly lengthy discussion that could take us a little bit astray.
Jim, was your question in essence, could you be prevented from offering a public prayer at like a town council meeting?
Pretty much. Like, I own a piece of property in another county. I pay taxes to that county, but I don't live there. Why should they be able to exclude me from getting in the queue to deliver an invocation?
Well, we don't know that they could. The town, well, yes?
Let me be specific.
Okay.
It's Roanoke County.
Okay.
And I've read their description of who they allow.
Oh.
And it's a hot topic in Roanoke at the present time.
Oh, I see.
And I believe they do limit it, as you described earlier in the show, to only residents of the county. Mm-hmm. and the type of selection of out of the phone book type of selection.
Jim, if it's not too personal a question, I'm curious, the ordination that you got, is it affiliated with any particular kind of religious organization, Christian or otherwise?
My ordination is from Universal Life Church.
Okay, so that's not considered a Christian faith.
You know, I don't know. It's pretty wide open, but it's a legitimate religious organization.
So the standards that this U.S. Supreme Court decision seemed to hand down based on what was going on with the town of Greece in upstate New York were that the town was perfectly within its rights to only be selecting from a list of houses of worship within the town's borders. And within the town's borders, there were only Christian houses of worship.
But it did have a policy. The problem there that the dissent pointed out is that it had this policy that anyone could offer the prayer. Didn't have to be. And when they wrote to congregations or when they contacted congregations, they did contact them as congregations. They did not direct their letters or their phone calls only to clergy. They just said someone from your congregation. So they were not insisting on clergy.
But I guess what I'm trying to get to in terms of Jim's question, having ordination for a church that probably does not have a house of worship in Roanoke.
Right.
That if Roanoke adheres to the same standards that the town of Greece was, the Supreme Court says that's fine. Jim can be excluded from because he doesn't live there. He doesn't run a house of worship. He doesn't attend a house of worship. We don't have a Universal Life Church house of worship in the town of Greece or
sure.
In the city of Roanoke.
I don't think you can take it that far.
You're not going to make a ruling for us.
No. Well, one thing about Supreme Court opinions, they are limited to exactly what they say. They said the town of Greece was not discriminating with its policy because, in fact, its policy said anyone could offer such a prayer, including an atheist. Didn't specify you had to live in the town of Greece.
But wasn't part of the argument made that they didn't give any publicity to
right.
That
they did not publicize that. And that was an objection that the dissent had, that Justice Kagan had, and those who joined her, Justices Ginsburg and Breyer and Sotomayor.
Jim, another fascinating question. We may have to wait for the Roanoke court case before we get the final answer, but thanks so much for joining us on Virginia Insight. We have another question here on the Virginia Insight Facebook page, this one from Lawrence. Ann Massey, Lawrence says, quote, I am confused by arguments from conservatives who want more prayer and religion in government. If you believe the best government is less government, and if you believe government all too often messes things up, then wouldn't you want to keep government as far away from religion as possible?
Well,
end quote.
There are probably a number of people who would agree with that, but there are also a number of people who don't. And he may see what he's describing as somehow self-contradictory, but a number of people don't think so. Now, in fact, I sat at dinner the other night next to someone who I discovered as we were talking actually has had a Master's of Divinity, an MDiv degree, Master of Divinity, which is the degree for people pursuing ordination. He did not do that, and he works for Washington and Lee in a totally different capacity. But he said to me, you know, as a Christian, I really don't care for the use of prayer as just sort of a ceremonial beginning to some kind of meeting or legislative session. It should be more than that. I don't like the government using prayer in that way. And in fact, in the town of Greece, those plaintiffs had amicus, that's friend of the court briefs, filed by religious organizations that agree with the statement I just told you about, that said, as religious organizations, the notion of what is often referred to as the civil religion or the civic religion that abides in our public institutions, in the legislatures and policymaking bodies, is offensive to them because, in a sense, it doesn't mean anything.
Well, somewhere right now is someone listening who has long thought there's been far too much effort to separate church and state in America. Someone else listening thinks religion and government in the U.S. are not nearly separate enough. If you are either one of these people and you'd be willing to share your perspective, we do have a phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967-2825. Or if you prefer to type instead of talk, you can reach us on Facebook, where we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Church and state legal scholar from Washington and Lee University, Ann Massey, is our guest. I'm Tom Graham, and here on Facebook, we've got this now from Laura, who says, quote, it seems that Greece, referring to the town we've been talking about in the Supreme Court decision, it seems that Greece's practice of calling a list of clergy members from established houses of worship would automatically have the practical effect of excluding atheists, even if the town council was theoretically willing to allow an atheist to offer a statement rather than a prayer. Did the majority or the dissenters in the Supreme Court discuss this issue?
No, not in quite the way the caller has described. They said that the policy was non-discriminatory. I suppose that assumes, in both the majority and dissent, that, for example, if the atheist woman who was a plaintiff had spoken up and said, well, I want to give a statement or thought at the next town council meeting, presumably they would have let her.
Except that they hadn't publicized the fact that that was their policy.
No.
If you came to them and asked them, they'd say, okay, that's our policy.
Right.
But it's was secret.
And they did. I mean, these other three people somehow did offer prayers at various times during, from what I can tell, one period in 2008.
The Wiccan priestess, the...
Yes, the Baha'i person and the Jewish layperson.
But right. Again, a little suspicious because those all happened after the original court case
after the
against
the
town
lawsuit
was filed. Okay. We've got Lynn in Stanton calling us here on Virginia Insight. Lynn, thanks for doing that. Your question or comment, please, for legal scholar Ann Massey.
Well, I am in the camp of big-time separation of church and state. I know that those words are not actually written anywhere in the Constitution, but I just think I don't like prayers at council meetings, at government meetings, and I'm also a little leery of things like the weekday religious education that can happen during public school time. So that's my comment.
Hold on for just a second for us in case our guest has questions for you.
Yes. The weekday religious education program has been challenged. The Supreme Court found that it was okay. Now, the facts in that case were very different from the program as it is practiced in Virginia. It had to do with Catholic children being dismissed from public school for an hour during the week and going to a Catholic church to receive instruction. In Virginia, it is primarily Protestant, I think, children leaving the classroom for an hour during the week and going to a site where WRE instruction takes place. The difference, or one difference certainly, is that in New York, that was only a few children leaving the classroom. And a lot of them were apparently embarrassed by it, although all instruction did cease while they were gone. But in Virginia, it tends to be almost all the children who leave, and the teacher is left glaring maybe at the one Jewish child who has not left and is keeping her from going to the teacher's lounge for an hour. Now, the case, the Supreme Court case, said if we had any notion that this was working some kind of discrimination, we would look at the case differently. Somebody did challenge the Virginia program years ago. It went to Judge Turk, who said, it looks to me like it's like it violates the Constitution. It went to the Fourth Circuit, and they said, you know, we really pretty much agree, but we have to say what the Supreme Court said, so we're going to uphold the program. I've always thought it was a shame that they did not say, yes, and the facts are very different, so we're going to come out differently and maybe let this go to the Supreme Court.
Lynn, do you have any particular biggest worry about, from your view, there not being enough separation between church and state?
Well,
maybe we lost Lynn there. But Lynn, thank you so much for your call. We're just about out of time, Ann Massey. So let me ask you a similar question in terms of what might be coming next on religious issues from this Supreme Court. Are there any big items that you see coming down the pike?
Well, I think one thing that's not coming next, which people have been mulling over and talking about challenging, and one person tried, we have religious references in our public life in a number of instances. For example, under God in the Pledge of Allegiance, in God we trust as our national motto on our coins and on our bills. Every session of any federal court begins, God save the United States and this honorable court. And I suspect a number of state courts do the same. So there are references in our daily lives that are so pervasive, we almost don't notice them. Some people have thought that maybe those could be challenged, particularly under God in the pledge, which was put in by Eisenhower in, I think, 1953. But after this case, that seems very unlikely because the majority certainly reaffirmed something Justice Douglas said years ago. We are a religious people. And even Justice Kagan, speaking for the four-person dissent, was willing to say that.
So one of the effects of this Supreme Court ruling is that it might tend to tamp down the likelihood of future religious controversies or from people who object to, as our latest caller was saying, there being too much connection between government and religion. Those people at this point in time with this makeup of the court will say, this is probably not a good time to be taking my case to the Supreme Court.
Well, I think they probably need to show discrimination or try to if they want to bring such a suit.
Our guest has been Washington and Lee University Professor of Law, Ann Massey. Professor Massey, thank you so very much for making time for us.
Thank you, Tom. I've enjoyed it.
Virginia Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers, Bob Levicky, Terry Ward, and Dan Easley. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jaspe and Inner Rhythm. Postings of Virginia Insight broadcasts are available on the Virginia Insight tab at WMRA.org. When you get to the page for today's broadcast, you will find links to more information about Ms. Massey and the work she is doing. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insights.